Good morning. Welcome to this Friday morning panel. It's the 22nd of March and a delight to have you. I don't know where you are. It may be rainy. It may be snowy. It may be nothing. But wherever you are and however you're celebrating this first Friday of spring, good on you. Hopefully it's going well. Let me introduce our panel to you. We have a lot going on today, so we will get right to it. And we always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And you can join in on the fun. All right. Nobody says fun quite like David Soares. He is the Albany County District Attorney. He joins us this morning. Hi, you.
Just saying, fun and district attorney, two words you just never ever hear the same.
Is it a felony or a misdemeanor?
I really like it. We're going to do felony fun today.
Okay, okay. Felony fun. Felony oh, fun. Well, the day's young. Aaron Pasitti is with us as well. He is a professor at Siena College where he teaches the subject of economics.
Which is also a word usually not associated with fun.
Oh, I don't know, but you make it fun.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you make it fun. Judith Eng joins us, senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics and former EPA regional administrator. Judith, good morning. How are you?
Great, although I think I'll change the name of the initiative and call it Plastic Free Fun.
Oh, plastic-free fun. Yeah, I think because fun is plastic-free.
Always. Mm-hmm.
Always.
Always, Joe.
Would you like to introduce your special guest?
Absolutely. I would be delighted for folks to meet Sarah Turbush, who is with the Natural Power Group. Sarah's here because she supports Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, a fantastic organization. We were both in an event for Clearwater last month, and supporting Clearwater got Sarah a seat at the round table for an hour and a half.
I just need to know, is there someone who actually doesn't support Clearwater?
Entergy, nuclear power plant. Oh, there you go. General Electric.
Entergy.
Mom and pop companies.
The bad. Well, welcome, Sarah. Very nice to have you in to observe what we do here. I hope we live up to whatever it was you were expecting. I don't know that we will, but we'll give it a shot.
Let's lower the expectations.
Nothing but fun here.
Speaking of fun, WAMC's Alan Chartak joins us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Fun.
Yes. Good. Well, welcome. Let's get started, and we'll go and find out what's happening today. And there's a lot. Okay, so let's begin with Golan Heights. This is the latest announcement. I guess we sort of saw this coming over a short period of time, in the sense that now when you look back on it and you're like, oh, they were building that to that. That's what they were building to. President Trump declared on Thursday that the United States should recognize Israel's authority over the long-disputed Golan Heights, delivering a valuable election eve gift to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but jettisoning decades of American policy in the Middle East. Remember, we used to care about that. Mr. Trump's announcement in a midday Twitter post came after persistent pressure from Mr. Netanyahu, a close political ally who is fighting for his survival in the election scheduled for April 9th, and has invoked his friendship with the American president as a prime argument for staying in office. But
those indicted together tend to stay together.
But Mr. Trump's move, while popular in Israel and among some lawmakers in Congress, is likely to be condemned almost everywhere else. The United Nations has rejected Israel's occupation of the Golan Heights since 1967, when Israeli troops seized the 400 square miles of rocky highlands from Syria during the Arab-Israeli War. It will also reverberate through the Middle East and throughout the Middle East, rather, and could undermine Mr. Trump's long-anticipated peace proposal for Israel and the Palestinians. The White House has been enlisting support for the plan among Arab leaders who now face the prospect of acquiescing in the loss of land they had long claimed as Arab. Alan, we'll go to you first and what you make of this.
Well, can you hear me?
I can.
Good. Okay, so it's a tough one. As you know, the Israeli security has always been tied in with the fact that their enemies have thrown stuff down at them from the Golan Heights. So the Golan Heights becomes very important. Now, in the meantime, apparently there's been some oil discovered over there, and that adds to the that adds to the entire mix. Nevertheless, the Israelis know what it was like to be under attack from the Golan. And, of course, as you say, Joe, the entire world is out there perhaps thinking about the captured territory. And it is not that it's not proven popular. However, you know, this is consistent with what Trump has said in the past. He moves the American embassy to Jerusalem, for example. A lot of people didn't like that either. He did it, and he didn't really care what anybody else thought, and it cemented his relationship with parts, and I want to be very clear about this, parts of the Jewish community, because there are plenty of people who are American Jews, I'm one of them, who do not like everything that the administration has done. So therefore, Netanyahu has done. So therefore, that's the way I see it right now.
So I want to go to everybody else, but I mean, there's a really good chance that what's going to happen to Netanyahu here, do you think, as far as the legal?
Well, first of all, his version of the Justice Department there has, in fact, indicted him.
Right.
Right. And so.
But he can still run and win.
He can still run and win. And there's American politicians have basically written the book on how you could still be indicted, run and win. So you have issues there. For me, the problem here is that this was just so naked, an opportunistic event that just took place that was done for the sole purpose of ensuring that this man wins re-election to the detriment of what I think peace in that region. He's basically Trump by Twitter yesterday basically has purchased for Israel, you know, perhaps another 50 years of extreme tensions in that region. Because you have Iran that's out there, you have Syria that is unstable at this moment, and the tensions between Syria and Israel are historic in nature. And now to take the very thing that has been at the source of all of that conflict and tension and just, you know, by Twitter, you know, proclaiming that, you know, we're gonna put our thumb on the or our Twitter on the scale of power and authority in that region, it speaks of irresponsibility, and the only thing you have to do, and I'll defer here, but is just reflect on the fact that you couldn't find any more different administrations than the Obama administrations and either of the Bush administrations, right? And yet, what you've had is consistent foreign policy as it relates to this region of the world, and so by Twitter, we've just bought Israel more tensions for years to come. And we've also ceded our, you know, position as the most trusted peacemaking authority, you know, throughout the world.
It also sets a precedent for other world leaders in terms of claiming land that they feel is theirs. One economic angle to this is that in the 1973 Arab-Israeli War that you know, we faced a giant oil embargo, which sent inflation upwards of 10%, led to mass unemployment, essentially led to a decade of stagnation in the U.S. So, you know, foreign policy decisions like this that have a tendency to, you know, kick a hornet's nest can, I'm not saying they will, but they have the possibility of, you know, those tensions taking the form of oil embargoes to the U.S. And the economic consequences that come from it.
I think it also illustrates how reckless this president is on foreign policy. Even, you know, Secretary of State Pompeo is in Israel, and he was surprised by the tweet. Our Secretary of State did not know this was coming. And I think this is the transactional part of the Trump administration. Netanyahu wanted a favor. He was pressuring Trump to do it. This sure seems to have Jared Kushner's fingerprints all over it. Never a good thing when it's a complicated, important issue. And my understanding is that Netanyahu is coming to the White House on Monday. This sure seems like a lot of American involvement in internal Israeli politics.
Well, isn't that the irony here, right? Is that America goes out of its way. There really is no purpose for Netanyahu to be visiting the White House other than in the closing weeks of his election to elevate his profile and to position him as this leader who's managed to achieve what no other leader has ever been managed to achieve, because we've never had a president as foolish and as irresponsible as the one that we currently have. Did I say a lot there?
Everything's up for grabs, even like the important issue of Middle East peace.
Yeah, you know, something about talking about this president and you using that particular term that I find a little troubling. Everything is up for grabs. Yes.
Alan, what do you think the chances of, I guess, looking into a crystal ball and saying, will Netanyahu win? And what if he's removed from office?
Well, he is going to be indicted. There's no question about it. The Attorney General has indicated that. And there does seem to be a kind of appropriate separation between the AG in Israel, or whatever they call him, and the Prime Minister, one which we really don't have here. If you're looking at the past and present situation. So, you know, he'll get it. I think he's going to get indicted. And there will be a certain amount of health pay as a result of that. I don't think there's any question. And I think the parallelism between the president of the United States, who is facing his own legal troubles, and that of Netanyahu is unmistakable.
Well, there's a difference, right, David, between, I mean, you can be indicted and still serve in office, right? I mean, so how did that, would the mechanism for him to
Chris
no longer,
Collins here in
yes,
New York.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, yes, you can do that. I don't know how effective you as a leader or a representative can be in a position, you know, where you're supposed to be focusing on efforts to improve the lives of others when you are experiencing the kind of you know, attention and the prosecution and difficulties that you'd be, you know, experiencing in that process. So I don't know how one would achieve that. I certainly think that being summoned into court, being cross-examined, and having your liberty, you know, at stake would be distracting.
But do you want to bet? Do you want to bet that 40% percent of the Republicans, David, will not move off the dime during that time?
I don't believe that they will move off the dime, because I believe that this particular base is untethered to nothing. They're not tethered to patriotism. They're not tethered to morality. They're tethered to power and maintaining power. That's it.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I think there's another way to look at it, and that is that they do see this as their patriotism. Look, I'm not arguing for them. I certainly don't like it. I think it's terrible. But I don't think they're going to move off the dime. And I think that if you examine their minds and what they were thinking, well, we're supporting what we consider to be the American dream, make America great again.
Well, it depends on what America we're talking about, because I certainly, you know, people that tend to look like me want to look forward in America and not go backwards, given our history. And the America that this particular president is shaping is one that is, in fact, going backwards, where there's dominance amongst classes, dominance amongst races. I mean, even his remarks purporting to want to reestablish industries that are long gone. Here's a man who's pining for, you know, an America that a lot of us are really grateful that's behind us.
Not to mention,
I couldn't agree more with. I just want to say one thing. I couldn't agree more with you, David. Nevertheless, I think it's tough to get inside the mind of that 40% and say what they're thinking. You know, that they're tethered or whatever, because they don't believe that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, not to mention just the profound lack of decency by the president. I try not to be surprised by anything, but his comments about John McCain this week were just remarkable. And I find it a little hard to believe that he's doing that just to play to the base.
Well, I you know, my perspective here, this tweet about Golan Heights, the John McCain remarks, all of those things designed to get us to talk about those things as opposed to what's really happening with this administration. Is it coincidence that we have news that's breaking about Jared Kushner and his use of non-secure technology to communicate and engage in governmental business? I mean, to me, I think that they were called by the New York Times, you know, earlier in the week and asked questions about that.
Yeah.
And then that set off alarms. And here you have this particular person going out and making these incendiary remarks. I mean, reprehensible remarks about a man who's you know, now not with us. And what are we talking about? We're talking about this, and we're not focusing in on Mr. Kushner.
Yeah, well, it is the art of deflection, and we've seen it since the beginning of the presidency and during the campaign, you know, when the Access Hollywood tape came out and they tried to deflect that. But this McCain criticism feels different to me.
Well, it felt different to me when I was watching it, and the room in which he was speaking to a group of veterans got eerily quiet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which I thought that was interesting.
Well, that sound that you didn't hear is a new bottom. And that's why those decent men and women who were in that room listened. That's why they didn't make that sound, because they recognized that they were experiencing live and in person a new bottom for this particular president.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Plus, we'll come back with Judith and Aaron and David and Alan, and we'll be right back. Well, that'll wake you up. That's great music. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok is here. We have David Soares, Aaron Pasitti. We have Judith Enk, and Sarah Turbush is in the studio with us. She's watching closely. Have we done anything to offend you yet?
No, you have not.
Okay, all right.
I actually, though, think you've given a lot more credit to these tweets than what I would say a lot of thought going into it and stuff. I don't believe there's as much background in happening as much as a just an impulsive president, from my perspective.
But it's policy, right? I mean, this is what we are now doing, and the world is reacting to that tweet.
I thought you were going to say that you were offended by the various dance moves that Alan was showing during that song.
No, I've never seen those. It was frightening.
He's cutting something.
Are you cutting something, Alan?
We have letters. We have letters.
Welcome.
Oh, brother.
All right, we have letters. Let's go to Jerry, who says, can we be critical of Russia interfering with American politics with Trump's promotion of Netanyahu in the current Israeli elections?
It's just so blatant.
Yeah.
All right, we go to Rich. I returned from Israel yesterday, went to Golan. With prior history of bombing from and current instability of Syria, current occupation of portion of Golan is important for Israel's security. I believe it will be returned when recognition of Israel by all occurs in the future. That from Rich.
I don't understand how we get there, Rich, with this particular president doing just the outrageous.
No. But his point about the past, which is that the Golan had been used to bomb the kibbutzim and others, I think is something that has to be sort of divorced from the debate about the unwiseness of this president recognizing Israel. I mean, it was de facto, right, that the Israelis were there and that nobody was moving them. This was an unnecessary move, it seems to me. It's not a question as to whether or not the writer is incorrect about what the Golan was used for, because we all know what it was. And that was before they owned the Golan. I want to take that back because I know it'll offend people, before they were positioned in the Golan.
We got this letter from John, who this was in response, I think, to Judith's remark about the Kushner, Jared Kushner's fingerprints being on this, saying this change in U.S. policy about the Golan has Pence's fingerprints on it as well. Remember what Libby says, the main influence on the U.S.'s policy towards Israel isn't American Jews, it's American fundamentalist Christians. Anybody on that? No?
Well... Well, I should keep my mouth shut, but of course there are going to be a huge number of American Jews who are committed to Israel who will feel good about this. I mean, look, we know that. This panel is not representative, of course, of that community. As you know, I've spoken out just right now against the idea that the president would provoke things this way. But there will be people who like it, and he knows it.
Julie says, recognizing Golan Heights further shows Jared Kushner's fervent commitment to the Israeli-Palestinian two-state solution and peace in the Middle East. Yeah, right. Just more dangerous chaos sown by the orange president and old pretty boy.
Wow.
Well, I mean, this goes back to the fact that, you know, Trump likes oligarchs, and since he's been cut off from a lot of international financing, that he's looking to countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia, in this case, for access to capital. And this seems to be a move that would increase the probability that he's appeasing people who are likely to lend money to him in the future.
Well, that's true, but completely self-serving,
well,
to
I know.
The detriment of an entire region who historically, I mean, you're talking about the epicenter of conflict in you know, the Middle East. And right now, We have no idea what's going to happen in Syria, right? The country's being torn apart into, you know, various pieces. We have no idea what's going to happen. And so to do this in the middle of what's happening in Syria, announcing, you know, troop withdrawals also by Twitter, you know, several months ago, it's like, well, where is our foreign policy? Who's in charge of it? Who's writing it? You know, to get to your point about impulse, shouldn't, as a matter of safety and security, shouldn't someone be in that room taking this man's phone away from him and saying, you can't do that?
Well, but shouldn't there be two guys coming up and just saying, please come with us?
Yes.
The George Conway theory.
Yeah.
Well, but you don't know if they're going to be in suits in white
US
nursing.
Marshals.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
But it is going to be two guys.
I don't know that I care now. Go ahead, Jim.
I think we will hear from the United Nations on this. There is a UN resolution that views the Golan as part of Syria that the whole world agrees with. So I don't think this is just going to go gently into the night. I think, you know, look, this is a very legitimate debate. It's really important. I'm always worried when the U.S. stands alone. Well, with in this case, Israel and Russia and no one else in the world.
You mentioned the UN resolutions, the UN resolution that prohibits the simple taking of land that you feel is yours. That's just been violated, which is sending a wonderful message right now to, if you're in the Kremlin, you're popping champagne bottles right now, because Crimea, it's now legitimate. And what are you saying to Erdogan? Right. And what are you saying to all the other leaders who are strong men throughout the world? If you feel like this country right here that was once yours can be yours again, go ahead. Take it. It's yours.
Our last letter writer used the word chaos. Jamie uses the word chaos as well. Every nation can make a claim that some part of a bordering nation presents a possible physical threat, but those nations use diplomacy to maintain security instead of occupation of your neighbor's land. I always say you must understand the goals of both parties to dispute if you have any hope of finding a solution. I question the motivation of certain political factions in Israel, and if peace is their goal, this party has found support in American evangelical right. Yes, they want the Temple on the Mount gone, and they will do everything they can to bring about the chaos such events would require. We got this from Jim, who says, Trump and Netanyahu, birds of a feather, both hate President Obama, and Hillary Clinton, both enemies of America.
You know, a bit of irony here as well, given the fact that today is the birthday of my
Carter.
First president, who was the last person to actually bring about peace in the Middle East.
James Earl Carter, 94 today.
Oldest living president.
Yeah, I came to this country. He was my first president. He was my first president. Yes.
Wow, that's a wonderful honor.
Yes.
What year? 19.
Not only that, but he survived a serious illness, which everybody had sort of counted him out on. So it's extraordinary, and in that way too.
Camp David Accords. Living
that's
history.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. An amazing, amazing man. Okay, let's go to some other stuff. We'll go to other stories and find out what else is happening in the world this morning. I do want to talk about Brexit. We talked about it yesterday, and there's been some more movement on that. Britain will not leave the EU next week after Europeans allow a short Brexit reprieve. European leaders on Thursday seized control of Britain's break, with the European Union sparing Prime Minister Theresa May the economic earthquake of an uncontrolled departure from the bloc next week, but demanding that she pass a deal or come up with an alternative by April 12th. The decision was a harsh verdict on May's political acumen. Withering cross-examination led her fellow leaders to believe she had no political strategy to pass a divorce deal, nor knew how Britain would weather an uncontrolled Brexit next Friday. May had promised the British people that Brexit would help them take control from Europe. Instead, she found that her 27 fellow EU leaders took back decision-making from her, dictating a political calendar for the coming weeks that give both sides time to prepare for the worst-case scenario. Seems like they've had a lot of time to prepare for the worst case scenario, but now they're cramming for the test.
I don't think you can prepare for a scenario like this. I don't think there is a viable plan aside from hunker down, cover your heads, and just hope that the damage is not catastrophic.
Alan?
And by the way, did you guys see the picture of May in the paper this morning? She had a smile that went from the left ear to the right ear. So, which I can only interpret as however small a victory, it was a victory, and I survived once again.
Yeah, or she was drunk.
I mean, there's not a lot to smile about.
I think it was the only good news this woman has had in a really long time. I gotta go with
just had a sportate. It was not alcohol. Sport. It was a sportate.
But Aaron, it's going to be an economic earthquake, whether it's March, April, May, June.
So economists do forecasting, and normally when they're not always right, but you can't forecast an event that is this uncertain. So in terms of the short-term costs, nobody has any idea, and I have not seen any good estimates of what that would look like. You would see trade flows stop. You would see capital inflows to England stop. I mean, it would send England immediately into a recession.
That tantrum, though, would have a ripple effect throughout the entire global economy.
Sure. Exactly. So the point is, in terms of the short term, that global contagion could most likely, and I should say that stronger, almost certainly lead to a worldwide recession.
What's stronger than contagion, man? That's like the strongest word. You said contagion, dog.
And even the long term
murderous
estimates,
contagion.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay.
I mean, you're looking at a shrinking of the British economy of 5 to 10% over the next 30 years. I just can't believe. I mean, it seemed like the referendum was approved. People got behind it, and then they started to think about it and say, uh-oh. And now that they've backed themselves into a corner, it's kind of like Trump's wall. It's like, we can't back away from this because it would be a sign of weakness, so we're just going all in and seeing what we can do. And there's been no sensible plan about preparations for how to deal with this, what the contingencies are, how you're going to deal with international capital flows and England's trade relations with other countries. They've back themselves into a corner, and I think May should just have a second referendum and say, can we please take this off the table and get back to normal life?
Alan?
Well, though, I was going to ask Aaron for what he just did, which is what should be done? Because, the picture he paints is so terrible that one would have to think that there has to be some kind of solution which has been avoided up until now. Now, if May were to say, and apparently she will not, because I think it's a double, triple, quadruple fake out. I don't think she ever wanted them to stay in the EU, although she made certain protestations of that kind. I don't think she's willing to have that second referendum.
She's in a lose-lose position. If they move forward and engage in Brexit, the economy is going to tank. Mm-hmm. They're going to call for her.
I think tank is an understatement.
Well, mm-hmm. exactly. But I mean, I have contagion is not on my verbal repertoire. But she's going to lose. Right. So it's a matter of whether or not you want to lose and be the poster child for the catastrophe to come, or do you just want to call for another vote and hope that there are more sensible people out there? And you may be mocked, you may lose power, but you will not be responsible for your nation going belly up.
And I think it's the responsible move, because certainly you can't not honor the first vote because the people voted, as unwise as it may be. But there's no shame in having a second vote.
The people voted, but let's not forget also that our friend Vladimir was also, you know, involved in influencing a lot of what went down.
Well, I just hope Brexit leads to Trexit. The Trump exit.
So, to speak.
I like that. I just made it up.
That would be nice. You know, the risk is that that this could also set a precedent for other countries who are part of the EU to leave as well.
I think it's going to be the opposite, though. I think other countries see what's happening in Britain. No, not us.
I would say some of the lesser developed countries in the EU, like Greece, and some of the southern European ones would. I mean, Greece went through an incredible punishment for their fiscal behavior in the wake of the recession, and I think GDP declined there by like 25%. People were moving back from cities to farms because they couldn't find jobs, so they're back, you know, raising sheep and fishing. The punishment that the IMF and the EU imposed on Greece specifically during this, I think, you know, Greece wanted out, and it came really close. So if England goes out, and you know, a recession hits other countries, might be like, well, they started it, we might as well jump on this.
We got to take a break. A lot of people are writing in that Jimmy Carter's birthday is October 1st.
Oh.
So
I heard on the radio this morning that he turned 94.
Don't always believe what you hear on the radio.
No,
but it was
no,
you know what,
today,
he,
today no, marks no, no, no. the fact that no. he's the longest
the
living
longest
president.
Serving. Yes. Yeah. Living.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Longest living president.
Apologies.
Okay.
Thank you,
all right.
Listeners.
A lot of listeners weighing in on that.
We're just wrong.
Okay. Got it. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters. We'll do that right after this. Good morning. It's Friday, the 22nd of March, and we're into spring. It's for what? Well, you're just shrugging your shoulders like you don't care.
It's March. It's March,
and it's snowing.
Can you feel the madness? All right, we have letters from Kevin, who says, "With all the attention on Trump and Netanyahu, the core issue gets sidelined again. The centuries of religious conflict continue." Russ says, Mr. Trump's fiat in taking the Golan Heights off the bargaining table while it reflects current realities is just another instance of the administration's withdrawal from the Middle East peace process. Mr. Trump doesn't see a profitable angle in the negotiations and will leave it to the other countries to continue the effort. With the rest of our involvement in the Near East considered, he's probably right. Larry says, while some may look at Trump's recognition of this portion of Middle East territory as reckless, when you cut it right down, his move is essentially meaningless. I highly doubt you'll see Syrian streets filled with protesters. Those poor people have other priorities right now. It will be a full century or more before this kind of civility to the country returns, when they can even make a rational decision on it. But the Trump spin team will try to show how brave he is in the face of terrorists. That piece of real estate has been in Israeli hands for decades, and the issue is not on the front burner. And there's brave Sir Donald acting like a conquering hero, in his own words, sad. Gordon writes, the U.S. led a coalition of nations to drive out Iraq when it seized Kuwait by military force. Does Trump think that was a mistake? And Lisa final letter for this moment. Lisa says, Trump consistently plays into Putin's hands. Now stating Golan Heights should be Israeli territory. Great. Javanka, using WhatsApp and private server, lock him up. Everyone hyped up that Mueller report will come down today. John McCain, not a hero? What is going on in our country? Well, we don't know. Lisa, we have no idea.
But Joe and Lisa, one thing we do know is that with the Trump administration, it consistently gets worse.
True.
You know, it's always worse.
With the hailstorm of scandal, you know, this week, and today's Friday, you know, you forget that the monster, this guy hosted a monster in the White House this week, and that's the president of Brazil, who is far worse than this particular president.
Yes.
And that man was allowed to walk into the sacred halls of the White House.
And you know what's odd? Once again, the husband from hell and Melania are traveling to Mar-a-Lago today to welcome countries from the Caribbean, and they're not doing it in the White House. They're doing it at Mar-a-Lago. Teresa Bourgeois actually had a really good quote on tweet on this. Why are there official meetings at Mar-a-Lago and not the White House? It's a private club.
Yeah. Trump needs to get his golf fix in.
I know, but we're getting used to receiving heads of state at the golf course.
Well, I think probably they've mistook it because these would be people of color, so they would be coming into Mar-a-Lago, and perhaps Melania thinks that they're there to apply for work, you know, work visas.
I went there.
Really?
I
felt that coming.
I went there.
I thought I was bad when I referenced the husband from hell. Really?
So I'm sitting there thinking, oh, George Conway and Melania are headed to Florida.
I got to say that when I was listening to Judith on that issue, the recurring thought keeps coming to my head. What is this woman thinking about the guy she's married to? I mean, does anybody else consider that issue?
Cha-ching.
Judith, be best.
Yeah. Oh, who can? I mean, wow. One of the things, I don't think we can get into any marital setup, right? I mean, no one can.
Let's talk about the Conways.
We can try. We can try to figure it out. I don't know. I go back and forth. Early on, she just looked so pained and just like a hostage.
Yeah, you kind of felt bad.
And you
for
felt
her.
Bad for
and
her.
And then you didn't.
And then.
Because she's smart. She knows what she got into. Cha-ching. Sorry.
All right.
What was written on the back of her coat?
She talked about that later, didn't she?
As to what it meant. If I care or sorry, I don't care.
I think in the interim, I'm in the minority.
I really don't care. Do you?
It wasn't be best.
Yeah. Right. I was going to say, I mean.
It wasn't even make America great again. It was, I really don't care.
Do you?
I liked her Christmas decorations, though. I think I'm in the minority, but I really like that.
You liked the those
red
Christmas decorations?
Yeah.
What's the show on Hulu there? The Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah.
You liked the Handmaid's Tale?
I don't know. We don't get broadband in Cambridge, so we can't stream.
Do you
culturally illiterate?
Do you think like Vegas isn't tacky?
You know, I just have to say
that there was
a subtle darkness
to it. Yeah.
For an administration immersed in controversy over their close, you know, relationship with Russia,
all
we're
going
to go with red trees this year.
American carnage. Yeah. Keeping
red
the theme
trees.
Going.
Sorry to open that.
That's all right. That's fine.
Thanks, Aaron, bringing out the worst in us.
We're going to take a break here, and we'll have more letters, and we'll talk about other things. I promised. Yesterday we had the story on the Fed rates, and I was going to do it yesterday, and I figured, let's wait for Aaron to do it.
Yay.
I'll give Aaron a present. He can talk about Fed rates because that is exciting.
I can't wait.
Our whole group is here. We have.
Can we have Barry White playing in the background while he talks about Fed rates?
David Soares is here, Alan Shartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pacitti, Mr. Fed Rate, and Sarah Turbush, are you having fun? Are you going to leave or are you just going to stay? You're
going to stay? I'll stick around.
Okay. Stay to the end.
That's great.
Because some people just run out of here during the long break.
Where's home base?
I'm out of Hopewell Junction in New York, downstate, but we have hydroelectric plants in the Hudson Valley.
What are the hydroelectric plants? What are those?
We have one in Wappingers Falls.
I know what they are. I'm just asking.
And one in Salisbury Mills.
And what are those called?
What are they called?
What are they called? What's your?
Well, Natural Power Group is the name of the company that is over Wappingers Falls Hydroelectric, Wallkill Hydroelectric, and Salisbury Hydro Associates.
Is that the future?
My husband and I own and ride them. Probably not given this administration, but we can talk about that a little later, maybe.
Better than fossil.
What'd you say?
Better than fossil fuels.
Yeah, better than fossil fuels. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters and we have, and please don't change the dial. Coming up next, a discussion on Fed rates. With Perry White. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok is here. We have Judith Enk. We also have Aaron Pacitti and David Soares. We have a guest in the studio.
Sarah Turbush.
Thank you, Sarah. Sarah Turbush is here. I had misplaced the little card I had to tell me who's all on the panel. Good morning, everyone. And okay, so as promised, I know you've all been, you did everything you needed to do. You're back. You've gotten your snacks. You're ready. Today we're going to talk about the Fed rate. Now, you'll remember that the Federal Reserve said Wednesday that the United States economy was slowing more than it had previously thought and painted a far less rosy economic picture than the White House, as it left interest rates unchanged and signaled little appetite for raising them again in the near future. Take it away, Aaron Pacitti.
Yeah, this is probably some of the most surprising economic news to come out so far in 2019, at least for the U.S. So the Federal Reserve is the central bank of the United States, which means that's where private banks go to get money. So when the Fed's trying to juice the economy, they inject money into the financial system, and interest rates fall. It makes consumer and business borrowing cheaper. When the Fed's trying to slow down growth, they suck money out of the system, and interest rates go up. So back in the fall of 2018, Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, said, we're planning on probably 4 interest rate hikes in 2019. And they seemed pretty committed to that, and there was a fair amount of unanimity amongst the other members of the Federal Open Market Committee. And then all of a sudden, they said, yeah, it's probably not going to happen at all in 2019, and there's actually the probability of rate cuts that might happen. So they have done a complete 180 in the span of 4 or 5 months. So the big news here is not that the Fed didn't change interest rates. It's the fact that they really, really, really significantly downgraded their forecasts of growth in the U.S. economy, not only this year, but also in 2020. And their estimates, which I think are far more reliable than estimates that are, you know, politically motivated, no matter the administration, than the White House. So they lowered their growth rate forecast for 2019 from 2.3% to 2.1%, and then for 2020 down to 1.9%. So they're expecting the economy to slow. And in their statement, they had one sentence that really caught a lot of people by surprise. They referred to economic and global uncertainties. And that is a laundry list of things like Brexit, slowing growth in China, the looming
trade war
with China, the fading effects of the Trump tax cut, the slowing of consumer and business confidence. And it's you're starting to see kind of a collection of events, none of which have really come to pass, that if any one of those go, whether it's Brexit, which would be, like I said before, catastrophic, or further decreases in consumer and investor confidence, or a full-on trade war with China, that could likely send the economy into a recession. So I think the Fed made the right move by saying, all right, we're holding off and we're going to be really patient in 2019 about raising interest rates, which would slow the economy. And this brings up an interesting political possibility, too, because if the Fed says, all right, we're going to try to promote growth by keeping interest rates stable, keeping borrowing costs low for consumers and businesses, and perhaps even lower them, if a recession happens, Trump's not going to have the Federal Reserve to blame. And I think that puts him in a very weird spot.
He'll blame Hillary.
Sure. I mean, he will find somebody to blame, but he won't be able to blame the obvious culprit.
Alan?
But Aaron, it's fascinating. But my question to you is, a lot of people have assumed all along that Powell got the memo, mm-hmm. you know, basically from Trump and said, don't you dare. And that another norm, which is the independence of the Fed, fell. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Now, I know that that's an alternative to what you've been saying here. And, you know, I have great respect for you. I really do. But there are those who just think he got ticked off.
Yeah, but, you know, so the Federal Open Market Committee is more than just Jerome Powell. There are a handful of appointees
right.
that have come from previous administrations. It's the way their terms are staggered makes it impossible for any president to stack the deck in terms of that. So I honestly believe that they heard what Trump said, but they didn't get the memo. They're paying attention to these other things, and you know the Fed's a very technocratic institution. They're, you know, Congress can't rescind decisions the Fed made, but I think they're just responding. I mean, I honestly think the Fed should not have been as aggressive in raising rates in 2018 as they were to begin with. But I think they're operating beyond politics here. I think the global headwinds have become significant and large enough that the Fed's trying to do whatever they can just to kind of say, we don't want to rock the boat.
Aaron Pacetti is the lantern in the economic darkness.
Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's what. We do know that when Powell began to do that, the president of the United States, this very same guy who has threatened other people and yelled at him. And almost immediately thereafter, he backed off.
Yep.
I mean, one and one is two.
But then the Brexit deal became more dire. Then the trade negotiations with China became more uncertain. You have slowing growth in the EU. You have slowing growth in China. All of these things are becoming transparent. And I think the Fed is responding to that. I can't get in Jerome Powell's mind and say, yes, he got the memo. But, you know, Trump was also criticizing Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen under the Obama administration for keeping rates too low. So, you know, I mean, believing what he says is, I don't know, fool's errand.
Now, yeah.
All right, we have some letters. Let's go to those, and then we'll move on to another topic or two before we head out today. Chris is checking in and says perhaps they can get a new vote before this is about Brexit. Perhaps they can get a new vote before the Internet Research Agency can sway it. All right. Janos in Great Barrington says, really? Why do you keep talking on behalf of Britain and its people who voted in majority for Brexit? Maybe they do not want to be the US's and IMF's lapdog anymore and be a sovereign nation without any foreign influences. Did that ever cross your mind? And in doing so, be willing to face the short and long-term consequences. Freedom is worth more than 5-10% GDP. Globalization is on its way out.
Perhaps. So, you know, a 5% reduction in GDP also means a 5-10% reduction in incomes and living standards. So,
yeah, I think those are good points. I do think, though, that most Brits have buyer's remorse on the vote.
Ed writes, what's wrong with moving back to farms and fishing for a living, like someone said about Greece? We need all our farmers.
That's correct.
I knew you were going to catch it for that. I almost said it myself, but I decided I didn't want to take advantage.
When you have college-educated individuals who are looking for jobs in growth-intensive industries, who are literally being shut out because of IMF, European Central Bank, and EU policies. You have downward economic mobility. That's the issue. There's nothing inherently wrong with farming or fishing as a profession, but when you have downward economic mobility, which I guess that was the metaphor I was using to describe that, that's not what you want out of agreements like the European Union.
We knew what you meant. You were.
But it was
not
worth clarifying.
You were not
fair enough. No, absolutely
and
not.
Fisher people, you never would do that.
Aaron is the lantern in the economic darkness.
Can you say that with a deeper voice?
I'm going to try to get Barry White voice in a minute.
And final letter on Brexit. Alan writes in and says, let's hope that the Labour Party with Jeremy Corbyn as its head soon leads Great Britain. His policies on Brexit, the environment, healthcare, and education are just what the British people need. Theresa May has no idea what she's doing other than surviving another day.
Do you ever watch the Parliament?
As much as I can.
Yes. I mean, some people watch like the British baking show or food shows. I love watching the Prime Minister pop up and have to defend her position. Imagine if we had that in the United States.
You know, I don't want to leave what Aaron was talking about a few minutes ago, because I do believe that what is painting our neighbors in England is the exact same issue that's painting, you know, our nation right now. And that's this entire global economy that seems to be locked in together, and people all over the world are feeling, you know, the bumps and in some cases the pitfalls that we're all experiencing economically, and something's got to change.
Sure. I mean you can argue that there's a lot of class biases associated with the current global economic order in terms of labor rights, in terms of environmental issues. There are other ways to organize a global economy than the one we have now. I think the issue with Brexit isn't fully addressing that. I think I've never heard a good rationale, economic or otherwise, for why England wants to leave the EU, aside from those kind of tribal issues of racism, xenophobia.
Yeah, but you pointed out a little earlier that this reaction from it's an angry tantrum-like reaction coming from England. And
where did they get that idea?
You can see maybe France being next. You can see Italy. You can see a lot of countries looking to back out of previous agreements because it's not benefiting the majority of the people that live in those countries, right? Because of the very issues that you talked about. Labor, you know, people not being paid enough, earning, you know, a living wage.
Right. I mean, it's not a problem of globalization per se. It's an issue of the policies that have led to stagnant wages for the bulk of the population for the past four decades, rising inequality. I think that's a lot of what they're responding to. And you can restructure global or continental trade agreements or monetary agreements so that they do benefit the middle class, the working class, the upper middle class, instead of just a handful of wealthy financiers.
Alan?
I just wanted to go back to an obscure point that Judith just raised. You all remember, of course, the words of and the book by Estes Kefauver?
obviously.
Anyway, yes. Well, Kefauver, who is a senator who was known for wearing a particular kind of hat, you may remember, and running for public office president, made the point, Judith, that we should have question time in the United States, and it made all the newspapers at the time, and of course, it went nowhere.
Well, it would be a nice kind of thinning of the herd in terms of elections, in terms of who could actually stand up and do that.
I think he'd get up there. This president would get up there and go hum, 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 and talk for an hour in response to every question. I don't know that they could keep up with him.
Well, maybe we could start it at the state level in the New York State Legislature as a pilot program.
That's a good idea.
All right. We have just about 5 minutes, so let me go to another topic, and that is about drilling. A federal judge demands a Trump administration reveal how its drilling plans will fuel climate change. I find that funny. Federal judge ruled late Tuesday, that the Interior Department violated federal law by failing to take into account the climate impact of its oil and gas leasing in the West. How could such a thing be the case?
Usually they tell you. I'm sorry, Judge, but usually they tell you which president appointed which judge when they tell you the ruling. I'm sorry, Judith. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know who did in this case, but this is a very important case. This involves 500 square miles in Wyoming, where the Department of Interior is opening up federal land, our land, for oil and gas drilling. And the Obama administration had a policy that when you do that, you need to consider the cumulative impacts on climate change for these energy development projects. The Trump administration didn't completely ignore that, but they did it wrong, and they really minimized the climate impacts. What's so important here is this comes on the heels of a very similar decision out of a court in Montana. And what people need to understand, you kind of, especially, you know, we're not out west. We don't understand that how vast the federal lands are. Well, a quarter of all of our nation's CO2 emissions come from extracting and burning fossil fuels on federal land. So this is very, very important, not just for our nation, but the world. So requiring the Department of Interior, ironically, you know, exists to protect our land, requiring them to look at climate and CO2 and methane impacts when they hand leases to private companies to drill is quite significant. We don't know if the federal government is going to appeal this decision, but given that the Trump administration is a wholly owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry, I assume they will appeal.
So the judge is a Obama appointee and briefly presided over the case of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, but eventually recused himself from the case. So that is what we know about.
I like Obama appointees.
But it seems like we have to make these distinctions more frequently now in this age of Trump, right?
We look at the laws differently.
Yeah. Like you would never think of going to get, you know, medical services at a hospital and wonder whether the surgeon is a Republican or a Democrat. But now, you know, every person who was otherwise trusted to do their job and be professional, we now have to go into the back of the baseball card to see who they voted for, who did they donated for. And it's just terrible.
Well, quick, funny story.
Well, it may be terrible, but do you think it's inappropriate? I mean, it is with some regularity that when you see who appointed, because I've always felt judges are politicians, and that's how they got their start. In fact, someday I suspect you're going to be a judge. I think it's not inappropriate to ask that question.
I don't think it's inappropriate to ask those questions. I think we're asking those questions so much more because we have this inherent distrust of the people who we're putting in certain positions. And these positions have become much more politicized. And you know, you should be asking those questions. People, you know, I think I was the person sitting in this room when everyone was talking about this amazing blue wave. And I'm like, yeah, it's a blue wave, but it's a red monsoon in your judiciary.
Let me wrap up this discussion with a quick, funny story. Do you ask your surgeon or your doctor their political affiliation? Years ago, I was working with community leaders in Albany to shut down medical waste incinerators at all the hospitals. No pollution controls, used sources of pollution. My mom, my deceased and beloved mom, Helen Enck, was in Albany Med for surgery. And, you know, they let one family member walk in at the end before you go through the swinging doors. And the surgeon comes out, and I'm standing there with my mom, and he's looking at the chart, and he says, Helen Enck, are you related to Judith Enck? And my mom said, no. And then when she woke up from surgery, she opened her eyes and said, I'm sorry. It just didn't seem like the right time to tell him. I said, you did the right thing, Mama.
Oh, Your own mother. Yeah, well, there you go. I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning. Sarah Turbush, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks for supporting Clearwater. Thank you for being and supporting us. And it's very nice to have you as a guest in the studio.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a blast.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much. I mean, just seeing David dance alone is indeed worth the price of admission,
isn't it?
It makes it worth it, without a doubt. Alan, have a beautiful day. In the Big Easy, thank you very much. Judith, thank you very much. Aaron, we'll see you next week, and David as well. Thank you. We'll be back right after this short break.